We now join our special coverage of the special hearings by the Senate Banking Committee on the auto industry bailout, already in progress.
Step forward, Tin Man!
Our industry, which represents America's real economy, Main Street.
You dare to come to me for a heart, do you?
Needs a bridge to span the financial chasm that is open before us.
You clinking, clanking, clattering collection of collisionous junk!
Yes, Your Honor.
Looking for some heart, GM CEO Rick Wagoner asks for a bridge and gets his head handed to him by skeptical senators, Congress, and the car makers. Now, if they only have the brains, it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, November 19th, and there certainly wasn't a whole lot of sympathy on Capitol Hill for those car makers.
Well, I missed that part of the hearings yesterday, but this morning I was looking at it. It was actually a lot more heated than I'd remembered. Good morning, Adora.
Today we have an overview on the financial rescue plan, including proposals to help save the auto industry and Congress, pirates striking twice, and new ways to help you do your banking. All that coming up. First, these headlines.
Well, they say duck is best served with a cherry reduction sauce, but lame duck is boring and best avoided. But the current lame duck session of Congress is actually worth a look this time. Lawmakers are busy. Yesterday, the heads of GM, Ford, and Chrysler, as we said, made their case to the Senate why they need a $25 billion loan, and they need it now. Here's Chrysler CEO Robert Nardelli.
Given our common supplier base, the bankruptcy of any one automotive manufacturer, we believe, threatens the viability of all automakers.
Even though it's estimated 3 million jobs are at stake, they met a chilly reception from doubtful senators, even as the automakers promised to pay the loan right back, and a couple of them even promised to cut their own salaries to just $1 a year.
Over in the House, Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson was defending the way he's spending the $700 billion blank check, and he wasn't doing Detroit any favors.
The purpose is of stabilizing and strengthening our financial system, and I've said to you very clearly that I believe that the auto companies fall outside of that purpose.
More economic news this morning. In about a half hour, we'll get the consumer price index, and markets are expected to be lower, but they may react to the number. Energy prices are moving inflation down, so that could be a positive sign.
We finally have a winner in the Alaska Senate race. You can put away the foam fingers and pom-poms. The game is basically over. Democratic challenger Mark Begich defeated Republican incumbent Senate staple Ted Stevens. It took 2 weeks to count the votes, but Begich won by more than 3,700 ballots.
Minnesota and Georgia are next. Oil is at $54 a barrel in Asian trading. The Dow is expected to open lower this morning, but that CPI number will be really important. It happens in about a half hour. It's debt week on The Takeaway. And we're talking about banking. Do you feel like your bank has wronged you? Do you want to change your relationship fundamentally with your banker? What sort of surprise fees do you find on your bill? We're interested in all those kinds of stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and we've gotten a bunch of great ones. Also, mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
There are some signs that credit markets, while still strained, are improving. Interbank short-term funding rates have fallen notably since mid-October, and we are seeing greater stability in money market mutual funds and in the commercial paper market.
That was Fed Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke yesterday defending how he and the Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson are handling the bailout package. They were speaking before a congressional committee. Also on the Hill were the heads of the big three car makers pleading for their own bailout. For more, we go to Todd Zwillick, who reports for PRI's Capital News Connection. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning.
Let's start with Paulson and Bernanke. They sure got a grilling on the Hill.
Well, they went into Barney Frank's committee. That's the place to go for a grilling, I suppose, for almost anyone in Washington, certainly for Paulson and Bernanke. So they talked about the bailout, but one thing that Paulson did do, he went, and you played a clip earlier of him saying that a bailout for the Big Three is not what he had in mind for this rescue plan. He then went behind closed doors with senators in their lunches and told them individually and personally that he didn't support this and he did not want to see this money used for the Big Three. So if they didn't hear it in public in the morning, they heard it in person from the secretary in the afternoon.
So is that the end of it?
Well, it's not the end of it. I mean, it's not dead until it's dead, is it? The idea of using the TARP money, that $700 billion we talk about all the time, that idea is pretty darn close to dead. There might be another way for them to get some money. We'll know more by the end of the day today once the Senate goes through some procedural fits and starts if there might be some money available. But it probably won't be new money, and it almost certainly won't be this TARP money. They might get the ability to use some existing money that they wanted to use for something else. They might get access to that. They won't be thrilled with it, I'm sure, if they even get that. There's a good chance they'll get zero.
So when you say TARP, you're referring to the Troubled Asset Relief Program, which is part of the $700 billion monies to bail out the financial industry.
Yes, correct. That $700 billion big effort, the bailout rescue.
All of our money there, Todd. You know, yesterday there was a lot of lecturing on the part of some of the congressmen and congresswomen about, you know, is the dollar over with? Do we need a gold standard? That sort of thing. Any sign of a core of maybe obstructionist Republicans who are likely to try to shut some things down either on this plan or on the auto industry plan as we go forward in this strange session?
Well, they're going on two separate tracks. You won't see any significant action probably on that $700 billion, the big rescue slash bailout track. That's probably not going to see any major changes this week. The Big Three, the auto question, comes to a head today and tomorrow in the Senate. And that small core that you're talking about, John, isn't small. It's nearly all of the Republicans and even a couple of Democrats. There is just not 60 votes for any approach for the Big Three as it stands right now. Now, the Senate has a way of putting together a deal on something, but as it stands, it's not a small group. It's a big group. The Big Three is not looking at success today unless, like I mentioned before, they find a way to get the money out of another pot that they might be able to get access to.
Well, there's certainly a lot more going on there in Washington yesterday. Let's talk about the Democratic Party dealing with Senator Joe Lieberman. What did they decide?
Well, they decided to let Senator Lieberman keep his chairmanship of the Government Affairs and Homeland Security Committee. He also gets to keep his chairmanship of a Armed Services Subcommittee. What he loses is the chairmanship of a Global Warming Subcommittee. Global warming's a big issue. I'd say out of those three committees, it's probably tier three. So he got a little bit of a slap. You can determine for yourself whether that slap was, you know, across the face or on the wrist. I think people have different opinions about that. But he lost one subcommittee. He gets to keep his big ones. I think the interesting thing about this is not so much what was the retribution that was meted out yesterday against Joe Lieberman. It's retribution by a thousand cuts. I mean, Lieberman will be in the Senate for years to come. And I think real retribution will be determined over the months and years, in fact, with individual senators on an individual basis. Some of them have probably forgiven him for backing John McCain and criticizing Barack Obama, but a lot of them probably haven't, and a lot of them remain angry, and they will have opportunities in one way or the other, on a bill, on some money that he wants, on a favor that he wants, on cooperation or not, over the course of years to exact retribution or not. I mean, it's personal and it's subclinical and it will only unfold over time, I think, how it really affects his career and affects the Senate.
Todd Zwillick, thanks for joining us as always.
My pleasure.
Todd Zwillick, reporting from Capital News Connection.
For all you need to know, go, go, Todd Zwillick.
The Todd Meister. So a lot of discussion about the Big Three automakers yesterday on Capitol Hill who are looking anything but big as they faced the Senate Banking Committee and attempted to convince them that $25 billion would A, save them, and B, be enough to actually keep them from coming back for more money. Joining us now is the senior editor of Fortune magazine, Alex Taylor. Alex, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, John.
You know, this was really, I mean, for people who have covered the auto industry, this was a historic encounter between senators and those CEOs. I mean, there was blow-by-blow discussion of specific union agreements, and Gettelfinger was there of the UAW. There were specific sort of discussions of why do we pay workers and when we've closed factories kind of thing. I just thought the level of detail in these hearings raised the idea that these senators are extremely skeptical of anything, and it was bipartisan. Was that your impression?
Well, the other remarkable thing to me is how little respect the big three get on Capitol Hill or really anywhere in the country. I've been amazed at the backlash that's developed against them since they've gotten into this extreme cash shortage. There seems to be very little sympathy for their plight, the feeling they really haven't done enough to be competitive going forward, and that they've been paying the UAW workers too much.
You know, I guess I don't understand why that plays so broadly as a political issue, because, you know, we're talking about 3 million workers here, and it's not as though what GM has done, at least for the workers, is absolutely unprecedented, and in some cases actually had support on Capitol Hill from sort of labor-leaning Democrats. But all of a sudden, it's like they can't do anything right.
No, it's funny. They've been getting bad press in the 70s for bad quality, in the 80s for not being fast enough to catch up with the Japanese on small cars. But for the last 10 or 15 years, they've really been trying to be good citizens. But all that bad news seems to stick to them like glue. They just can't get rid of that bad image they've got.
Well, let's talk about one practical consensus that seemed to be developing on that Senate committee. And that was the idea that the Senate might prefer to revisit this issue only after the big three go into some sort of prepackaged, structured bankruptcy process. Can you explain what that's about?
Well, there's a lot of feeling that giving the big three money at this point would just be throwing good money after bad unless they are really serious about changing the way they do business. And the best way to get them to change the way they do business is to have them go into bankruptcy, where they have to go to the union and ask for givebacks and contract negotiations and go to their dealers and ask for changes in the franchise agreement so they can close all those Chrysler and Buick and Pontiac dealers that aren't really pulling their weight. So the Congress will be in a better position to negotiate, and the companies, because they won't have any alternative, will really be forced to come up with some radical solutions at that point.
At some point, Alex, though, is it a question of cutting off your nose to spite your face, not only in terms of how important the auto industry is to the economy, but in terms of speeding up innovation to meet the needs of the future?
Well, that's true, but these companies have been destroying capital for years and years. I mean, what's GM lost? $70 billion in the past 5 years, and to give them more money at this point, I can see where the impression is created that you are throwing good money after bad, and a bankruptcy would really be a lever, a very strong lever, to get these companies to really change the way they're doing business.
Well, Alex, listen to this. Here's Alan Mulally, chief executive at Ford, trying to sound upbeat.
The key to us going forward is, as we go through this, continue to invest in the new products, continue to invest in the continuing productivity, and we'll come out the other side and we're going to be a turbo machine.
A turbo machine, Alex. Now, the auto industry argument, let's not laugh too much. The auto industry argument is that if you just give us this money, we're going to get to a position where we can innovate and move forward and create cars that are going to actually help us with these other problems like the energy crisis. What's wrong with that argument before we go?
Well, basically the problem is the auto industry is a long-term product situation where it takes 3 or 4 or 5 years to get new products to market. So you're trying to solve a long-term problem with a short-term cash infusion, and the two just don't balance out. I mean, nothing is going to change between now and January in terms of what the big three are working on. If they get the money now, they've got their product plans and technology plans and fuel-saving plans already drawn out to 2013. So you've got a mismatch here between what Congress wants to do and what the
right.
big three need to do.
Alex, quickly, in a couple seconds, do we lose one or two automakers a year from now?
Two, I think. GM and Chrysler are really short of cash right now. It's going to be very, very difficult.
Man, Alex Taylor, senior editor at Fortune magazine, with a sobering prognostication on the big three, who again face the Senate Banking Committee on Capitol Hill. Thanks for being with us, Alex.
Email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. This morning we are gauging your thoughts on a possible bailout of the auto industry.
Hi, my name is Barbara. I'm actually calling from the New Jersey Turnpike. If they give $25 billion of our dollars, us taxpayers, to GM, part of this is going so the workers can have these fabulous pensions and fabulous health care that nobody else in the country has. And I don't know why my tax dollars have to go so they can have a great pension.
We're registering your opinions. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Also wanting to know whether you have a love or hate relationship with your bank and how do you feel the bank could treat you in a better way. Give us a call. We're going to move now to the coast of East Africa. It was a busy day there yesterday after an Indian warship destroyed a pirate ship near Somalia. Then another group of hijackers took on a Thai ship and an Iranian bulk cargo carrier. That followed the unprecedented hijacking of the largest supertanker on record on Saturday, a massive Saudi ship carrying $100 million worth of crude oil. So-called pirates are grabbing the headlines but also becoming a major international problem. How have they become so successful? We turn now to Neville Smith, deputy editor of the insurance and shipping newspaper Lloyd's List. Welcome, Neville.
Thank you.
How are these pirates, these so-called pirates, how are they operating so freely?
That's largely because Somalia is operating as a failed state. It's a country wracked by civil war, insurgency, and by lack of cohesive government on the ground. And many of the pirates started life as fishermen and have simply gone further afield and have become more violent and more desperate in their attempts to make money.
So who are these? Is it one group? Are they organized in some way?
They don't seem to be. They seem to be individual clans or groups or criminal gangs which operate seemingly on their own without that much coordination. But they do seem to have formidable resources, certainly lots of cash at the moment, as we're hearing, at their command. So they have large ships that they take out further out to sea, small boats that they use to go and hijack cargo ships with, using all manner of large and small arms.
As John has noted before, it doesn't take much to become a modern-day pirate, and it's working. Some of these ransoms have been $1-3 million. What are they doing with the money?
They're doing all sorts of things. We're getting reports about a lot of house building going on in the coastal towns of Aal and around there. Lavish weddings we're hearing, and lots of entertainment going on, because basically there's no real comparison with what's being earned from these ransoms as to what can be earned in any way legitimately really on land. So we're seeing a lot of conspicuous consumption as the pirates spend their booty.
So Neville, from the perspective of the shippers, make me an argument. Is it smarter to just pay the ransom, or is there an insurance policy that could possibly help you out here?
Well, I hate to say it, but effectively there is very little choice but to pay the ransom. I mean, there are a number of reasons for that. You don't really want a gun battle carrying on, particularly on a crude oil carrier with 300,000 tons of oil on board. You don't really want to meet violence with violence if you can avoid it. There is insurance cover. These ships, in fact, it must be said, are already paying a lot of extra insurance for the crew. They're getting paid more. The ships are having extra insurance cover to go through the Gulf of Aden and the Red Sea and up to Suez. So that's already priced in, if you like. So for the seafarers, they're actually left, the ship owners are left with very little choice. Once the prize has been taken, they enter the negotiations, and ultimately they almost always seem to pay.
There's been a whole slew of very high-profile hijackings this year, and it seems there has been a change of tactic with news of the Indian warship that destroyed a pirate ship. off the coast of Somalia. What do you make of that, Neville?
Well, I think that'll be welcomed by quite a lot of people. I mean, the conversations we're having, perhaps the ones which are off the record, if you like, that people don't necessarily want to be quoted on, are saying this has now got to a situation where the Navy resources that are in the Gulf really should be taking much more direct action when they see, when they locate these pirate ships, instead of... Previously, they've been monitoring a situation. There's been questions about jurisdiction, questions about what you do with pirates once you capture them, you know, where they're tried and where they're brought to any kind of justice. And also, as I said, that the navies don't necessarily want to make a bad situation worse. But I think it'll gain some praise in some quarters that there has been some really sort of tough action against pirates. Maybe it'll act as a bit of a deterrent.
But escorts are out of the question, and actually arming the supertankers with some sort of anti-pirate countermeasure, howitzer, zapper gun is probably not a good idea?
Well, things like that have been tried. There was an attack on a cruise ship much earlier this year where they used some sort of sonic weapon to fire, which they fired and scared away the pirates. That was a long time before the current upsurge we're seeing now, so perhaps those pirates took fright more quickly. This is a debate raging in the shipping industry and in the insurance industry, of course. Should you put armed security police on board your ship? And there are plenty of companies vying for those kind of contracts. But for the most part, I mean, there is a convoy system effectively, working. The task force is operating a security corridor through the Gulf of Aden and into the Red Sea. The problem is that you've got hundreds of miles of sea area, lots of ships there, and they can't provide coverage all the time.
Tough times on the sea. Thanks for that, Neville Smith.
Pleasure.
Neville Smith is a deputy editor of the insurance and shipping newspaper Lloyd's List. They got a real conundrum on their hands.
Well, they have to pay for insurance and they have to pay ransom. That's the interesting takeaway there. They're paying it both ways because the piracy, there's really no way to avoid paying. And the insurance doesn't really cover the piracy. It just basically, I guess, covers liability for the crew.
And Neville made the same point that you did. I mean, when you're talking about tens of thousands of gallons of oil, the last thing you want is a shootout.
Yes, indeed. So, Mark Garrison, we're through talking about piracy. Got some headlines for us?
Sure do. It's 20 minutes after the hour. News just out now that Al-Qaeda's number two man, Ayman al-Zawahiri, is criticizing President-elect Barack Obama in a new audio message. It's the first public Al-Qaeda comment about the president-elect's victory. Al-Zawahiri said the president-elect's plan to shift troops to Afghanistan is doomed to fail. The U.S. military has arrested a member of Iranian security forces for sneaking weapons into Iraq. They detained him at a Baghdad airport yesterday. The U.S. has long accused Iran of arming Shiite extremist groups in Iraq. Another U.S. missile hit Pakistan earlier today, killing six militants. This was the first attack outside the tribal belt near the Afghan border. That could anger Pakistan, who says recent American attacks on its territory violate international law. The FDA opening a branch in Beijing today. It's part of a new global strategy to make sure imports are safe. Chinese goods have been especially problematic. Contaminated blood thinners and toxic toys have both made their way to American shores. The Indian Navy is fighting pirates in the Gulf of Aden. A warship returned fire to a pirate ship that attacked it yesterday. The boat is specifically in the region to protect boats from pirate attacks.
And win one for the good guys, I guess. Pirates,
I'm trying.
Pirates go down. Thank you, Mark.
Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. So here's a question for you. How's that relationship with your banker going?
Both my wife and I are pretty well educated when it comes to issues like banking with an MBA. And we found, surprisingly, after signing our mortgage, that our fixed rate was only fixed rate for the home equity portion of the mortgage for anything that was borrowed after the initial amount. And as it turns out, our bankers didn't realize this either, and it wasn't until a year later that they admitted that they had made a mistake, but the paperwork was the paperwork, and it was a fixed rate. Really surprising.
That's a great story.
Painful.
If it wasn't so scary. Do you have a love or a hate relationship with your bank, or is it love-hate? Banking is a business. How would you make it better? The future of banking. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us your banking story at mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
John, you heard any rumors lately about who President-elect Obama plans to put in his cabinet?
It's like a balloon party down there with trial balloons every day.
There have been reports that Senator Hillary Clinton could be offered the job of Secretary of State. Former Harvard President Larry Summers perhaps offered the job of Treasury Secretary. And now reports that Clinton Deputy Attorney General Eric Holder will be asked to become the next United States Attorney General. He'd be the first ever African-American to take that job. New York Times correspondent Eric Lischbau has been covering that story and is on the line from Washington. Good morning and welcome back, Eric.
Good morning.
Certainly lots of leaks. Any confirmations?
No official confirmation from the campaign yet, but it seems like practically a done deal. I think really just the timing is the only question mark as to when it'll be announced.
Why do you think it's a done deal, and what would Eric Holder bring to the job?
Holder is someone who has a long and impressive resume in Washington, and more important, has become very close to President-elect Obama over the last couple of years. They met at a dinner party in Washington when new Senator Obama was first being welcomed to Washington in 2004, and became very close personally. And Holder has been a legal advisor to the campaign for the last couple of years, and was on his vice presidential search team. So they've really developed a close relationship, and it would be a natural pick. And I think it's something that a lot of people have been expecting for weeks now.
He certainly has a long resume. He was the U.S. attorney for Washington, D.C. He was a judge. He was at the part of a team of lawyers that was investigating corruption on the federal level for many years.
And he's a monster partner at Covington down in D.C., right?
Right.
Corporate firm. So he's got it all.
Yes. And he was the number two official at the Justice Department at the end of the Clinton administration. When Janet Reno was the Attorney General, he was the first African-American Deputy Attorney General. So this would be kind of a natural elevation for him.
How do you think he would bring a different perspective, or how would the Attorney General's office change under his rule?
Well, I think the biggest challenge for him will be to restore the credibility of the Justice Department, which obviously has taken quite a pounding last couple of years. At the end of the Bush administration, it's been one scandal after another for about the last 3 years now over the charges of politicization of the Justice Department, in the firings of the U.S. attorneys in 2007, in hiring practices, in legal memoranda on NSA wiretaps, tapping and torture and interrogation policies. So the morale and credibility of the Justice Department are really at a lot of people believe at an all-time low. So that I think will be his first task, is to bring back just the standing of the department.
Outside of that morale question, though, do you think there's any patience, any sort of history of Eric Holder delving into these kinds of constitutional questions that seem to dominate the Bush administration's two terms at justice, using the Constitution, obscure phrases in the Constitution to justify various kinds of national security changes without going to Congress?
I mean, he's someone who has taken on big investigations in the past as a line level prosecutor and as a United States attorney in the Washington D.C. office. So I think that's a decision that will probably be made in consultation with the White House, whether or not the administration has the stomach to really go back and investigate some of the things that have happened over the last 8 years, or whether or not the political calculation is that it's best to sort of move ahead without necessarily looking back.
There is one issue that's likely to come up, and that is the last-minute pardon of Mark Rich right before
Sure.
President Bush took office. You want to talk about that a bit?
Right. That's regarded as really the biggest blemish, some people would say about the only blemish on Eric Holder's resume, is his involvement in the pardon that President Clinton granted on his last day in office to Mark Rich, who was a fugitive financier involved in a major tax fraud scheme in the 80s. And Holder had essentially signed off on the pardon without going through the normal Justice Department procedures. There's a long, elaborate review process into possible pardons, and the White House, at the urging of Mark Rich's lawyers, had essentially bypassed that process, and Holder was the person who in the end said he was fine with the pardon going through, and that caused quite a bit of embarrassment and also investigation by Congress and others into his involvement.
Eric Lischblau, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Eric Lischblau is a New York Times reporter and the author of Bush's Law, The Remaking of American Justice. He's also a 2006 Pulitzer Prize winner. Now we go to Mark Garrison with the latest headlines.
Thank you. It's 21 minutes before the hour. Some key economic numbers just out. The consumer price index is down 1%. That's the primary measure of inflation. Also bad news in the real estate world. Housing starts dropped 4.5%. That number is down to the lowest level on record. Also breaking this hour, Al-Qaeda's number two man, Ayman al-Zawahiri, is criticizing President-elect Barack Obama in a new audio message. It's the first public al-Qaeda comment about the president-elect's victory. Al-Zawahiri said the president-elect's plan to shift troops to Afghanistan is doomed to fail. Leaders from the big three automakers spoke before Congress yesterday to ask for a loan. They'll face opposition from Senate Republicans like Richard Shelby.
I don't believe that they have immediate plans to change their model, which is a model of failure. I wish that they would. I know they're in dire circumstances, but, you know, somebody has to speak up for the taxpayer.
That's a senator just earlier this morning on CBS's Early Show. The White House also wants to keep the bailout plan money solely for financial institutions. The Senate race continues in Minnesota. A recount begins today in the contest between Republican incumbent Norm Coleman and Democratic challenger Al Franken. Coleman led by just over 200 votes in the first count. That's out of nearly 3 million cast. If the Dems win that race, as well as a runoff election for the Georgia Senate seat in December, they would hold a filibuster-proof 60-seat majority in the Senate. Also, Lolita author Vladimir Nabokov never published his final novel. It's called The Original of Laura. In fact, he left instructions for his son to destroy the manuscript, but his son didn't listen, and the book is out next year.
Thank you, son, says Vladimir Nabokov. Thank you very much, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
I'm Adora Udoji. This is The Takeaway.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And joining us now is Libby Casey in Washington, D.C. She is a Washington correspondent for the Alaska Public Radio Network. And if Libby is here with us, that means there's a headline out of Alaska. Ted Stevens is officially the loser in that Senate race. So it happened on his birthday, right, Libby?
That's right. A rough 85th birthday for Senator Stevens. Not only did he lose his election, it really got finalized last night, but yesterday morning he faced getting kicked out of the Republican conference. That didn't happen, but when a reporter said to him yesterday, "Happy birthday, Senator," he just looked at him and said, "I hope yours is a lot better."
Oh, that's kind of a heartbreaker. I mean, Ted is beloved to a lot of people up in Alaska. What do you think his future is now?
He really is. I mean, it's hard to quantify this. He's been a senator for 40 years. No one knows what he's going to do. He's an admitted workaholic. You know, he was just convicted on 7 counts of lying on his financial forms. And in the week since that, he said, you know, the one thing I do regret is not spending more time with my family. So we'll see if he takes his family up on that. But this guy just goes. He's like the Energizer Bunny of Washington. We don't know what he's going to do next. He actually may even lose his law license back in Alaska because of the convictions.
Which would mean even more time spent with his family. Right.
Right.
He's definitely going to be able to equalize that one.
Or not, because the question here is whether or not he's going to end up going to prison. I understand he's not going to ask President Bush for a pardon.
Well, his staff was quick to clarify that yesterday. When Stevens was asked, are you seeking a presidential pardon, he sort of dismissed the question. And they later said that wasn't a no. He's not seeking a pardon. It just hasn't really come up yet. He wants to let the legal process run its course. So they are not counting out that option.
You wouldn't turn it down, I guess.
I don't think anyone would turn down a presidential pardon. Absolutely.
So this really, you know, the other big story is that the ascension of Mark Begich, who's a Democratic challenger here, and a couple of words on who he is and what he is going to bring to the Senate. But also, this denies Governor Sarah Palin a chance at a big power play here because she could conceivably have reappointed a Republican if Ted Stevens was expelled from the Senate quickly.
Right. That's all put aside now. Mark Begich is coming to Washington. He's 46 years old. That's about the age that Senator Stevens was when he started his Senate career 40 years ago. He'll be coming down here as an Anchorage mayor with a lot of support in the Anchorage community. A lot of Democrats are very excited about this because it does move the Democratic Party closer to their goal of having a 60-vote majority. He is a name that people in Washington know because his father, Nick Begich, was actually Alaska's congressman decades ago and was killed in a plane crash. So this is a name that's returning to Washington. Mm. He's a born and raised Alaskan.
And the Palin question?
It's a moot point. She's out, but now everyone's going to be asking, is she going to run for Lisa Murkowski's Senate seat in Alaska in 2 years? Murkowski is a fellow Republican. That would be a very bold move to go after a successful fellow Republican seat, but that's on everybody's mind.
It's also a small world politically there in Alaska. The Murkowskis, the Begiches, the Stevenses, I mean, those names have been around forever.
Absolutely. We're recycling them. But, you know, a Democrat hasn't come from Alaska to Washington in nearly 30 years. So this is a huge change. Wow. Alaskans are waking up to a totally new world this morning.
Libby Casey, thanks so much for helping us wake up with the rest of Alaska. Libby Casey is, of course, correspondent for the Alaska Public Radio Network, reporting on all things Alaska for us. Thanks, Libby.
Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, November 19th. Mark Garrison has just joined us with some headlines. Mark?
Thank you. Coming up on 12 minutes before the hour, consumer prices plunged by the largest amount in years last month. The 1% drop is being attributed at least in part to a huge fall in gasoline and other energy costs. Republican Senator Richard Shelby just said a few minutes ago that he doubts a $25 billion bailout would do much for the auto industry. The heads of the top American carmakers returned this morning to Capitol Hill. Today they'll be on the House side. The big three on the Hill, you've heard that a lot, and that's definitely part of the story, but like, look carefully, and it's actually the big three plus one. In addition to the chiefs of GM, Chrysler, and Ford, right along there with them is Ron Gettelfinger. He is the union boss, the head of the United Auto Workers. And usually you see these guys fighting. They're fighting over money and benefits. There's strikes. There's lockouts. This is a week where they're actually on the same page because the unions support an aggressive bailout of the auto firms, and they're trying to help them and do that. Obviously, the union members will lose a lot of jobs if it goes under. And also it's kind of a part of the way you see the auto industry changing. There's been a lot of foreign cars that are being built here in America. Those are typically not union workers that are doing that. So watch what the United Auto Workers do as a part of this when you're looking at that, and not just the big three. There's another guy there. A small Shiite party in the Iraqi parliament vows to vote against the proposed new security pact with the U.S. But even if all the party's members vote no, the agreement is still likely to pass next Monday. One of the three fires that burned about 1,000 homes in California is being blamed on college students who built a bonfire. One official said the students apparently believed they had put the fire out, but smoldering embers were picked up by the strong Santa Ana winds. That's apart from the two fires in Los Angeles County that have also burned this week.
Those kids are in trouble.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mark. So in this series that we're doing all week, I guess just in time for the holidays, on Debtor Nation, a title you actually helped us come out with, we're thinking about what is the future of banking in the United States? What is the banking business? We're asking you to tell stories of what your relationship is like with your banker, 877-8-MY-TAKE or MYTAKE at thetakeaway.org. And all of our debt series is on our website at thetakeaway.org. So the Center for Future Banking is actually an institution. It's up at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, part of the MIT Media Lab. And the sponsor of the center is the Bank of America. And joining us now is the senior business executive from Bank of America, Jeff Carter, who's leading the Center for Future Banking up at MIT and thinking a lot about how the industry is going to change in the current financial turmoil. Jeff joins us from a former banking center in the United States, Charlotte, North Carolina. Jeff, thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, John. Thank you so much for having us.
How urgent do banks think getting to a future different kind of relationship between consumer and banker? How urgent is of an issue is that for the industry, do you think?
Well, we certainly think it's very urgent. I mean, we believe that, you know, we're living in unprecedented times right now, and the times, you know, to be blunt, are not good. What started really last year as a crisis in the subprime markets became really a global credit crisis, and now it's become a global recession. So we believe we'll begin to see a turnaround when the core problem, which is housing, reaches a bottom. And when that turns the corner, which we expect to happen sometime in the middle of next year, we believe that we'll see a return to GDP growth in a more normalized sense. I think it's pretty clear at this point that we're in a recession, and the fact is that as a society, we're drowning in debt. I mean, over the past 25 years, the growth of total U.S. debt, private and public, has outpaced the growth of GDP by a factor of 4-1. So there's no doubt that the state is urgent, and we feel a real sense to change the industry for our customers.
Well, Jeff, let's talk about a future banking relationship that perhaps wouldn't encourage borrowers to get into debt that is eventually going to drown them, and banks that actually encourage a sense of literacy on the part of consumers rather than simply focus on transaction fees, which some of our listeners have already described as pretty frustrating and difficult to follow.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think, when you take a look at, you know, how things are going to change, I think it's a little bit important to kind of understand how do we get into this current debt crisis. And, you know, we believe, as we said before, it's really this, you know, perfect financial storm. So the government encouraged subsidies for the housing industry. You know, appraisers and rating agencies, you know, they based their analytical models, which we believe are going to be a core of the transformation that happens in the industry, on recent historical data drawn from inside that growing bubble. And then the global savings glut created this massive liquidity, with global investors in turn chasing these higher and higher yields. That led to these very complex securitizations that were not always well understood by those investing in them, and in some cases even those that were creating them. But that promise of higher yields drove people, you know, further and further. Investment banks, freed from those leverage limits, began piling up debt, et cetera, all that combined to form a society-wide, you know, consensus that house prices would raise forever. So that was really at the core of the debt. So what we believe is that, you know, the financial services industry that emerges from this crisis is going to look very much different. It's only going to include a handful of very large, diversified global firms on one end of the spectrum, thousands of small local community banks on the other. And the credit markets are going to have to be far simpler, more transparent, and it's just going to be a smaller industry.
It seems like it's going to have to play to what is the essential value part of the equation here, and that is a relationship between a single banker and a single consumer, and the understanding that maybe that banker has, because they know this person, that they can actually pay back a loan, and the consumer knowing that banker is going to back them up when push comes to shove. If you know that information, it doesn't really matter what the rating agency says, right?
You're absolutely right. And, you know, if you look at just for a moment, if you look at, you know, the financial stock share of the market from the S&P, we grew from 8% to 22% over the last 17 years, and no one in banking was complaining. But it'd be fair to say that growth in financial services was overdone. And I don't think it would hurt to remind anyone that we play a supporting role in the economy. Banks play a supporting role, not a leading role. So financial services is really a means, not an end. And we believe that our job is really to enable the creators of economic value and to enable the people that are our customers, people who make things and people who use them, to get better and do business. And certainly I think as an industry, we're all sensing some humility in that. I think to your point, you know, the new financial services industry that emerged, I think it's going to be shaped by two forces. One, which you mentioned, which is free market and people of the country expressing their preferences. And then obviously the regulatory environment. I think if you spend a little bit of time on just the free market side, there is no doubt that we're all going to go through. I mean, I think each and every one of us is going to go through a painful process of rebalancing our personal balance, you know, and family balance sheets. And debt has become such an outsized variable in that equation. So as a country and as a culture, we believe that we're going to see a renaissance and more of a return to a savings culture. Uh-huh. I believe that's going to be the core of this transformation.
And part of this transformation, Jeff, can you give us one example of something you think will be done differently that perhaps will make my life as a consumer easier?
Yeah, I think you know the key word that I would say in all of this is just transparency. And so I think, you know, consumers drive our economy. There's no doubt about that. And consumers are going to have an ability to take more control of their financial future. And what that means is that we're going to have transparency. John mentioned in the beginning, there's this whole move towards transactional-based and service-based pricing models. I think you're going to see a lot of the future around these customer-based models, which are not transactional-based at all.
So moving away from fees and moving towards maybe more of a credit line with a very strong sort of relationship between the banker and the borrower.
Absolutely. I mean, relationships are going to be key.
And it gives me a bit of optimism to hear Jeff talk so optimistically there. Jeff Carter is a senior business executive from Bank of America, which is leading MIT's Center for Future Banking up in Cambridge. And we're talking about the future of banking. And one listener called and said she was unaware that she had a adjustable rate mortgage. And someone on our website says, how do you not know what kind of mortgage you have? Was she not there? Did she not sign the papers and agree to an adjustable rate mortgage? I feel bad, but how can you be so out of touch with your own life that you don't know what kind of mortgage you have and what that means? Not a lot of sympathy there.
No, not a lot of sympathy, it seems, for the auto industry and their efforts for a bailout either.
Hi, this is David from Putnam, Connecticut. I think the United Auto Workers ought to be the one that are bailing out the big three. My father, 30 years plus as an elementary school principal, makes less than a guy putting on fenders at GM. What's wrong with this picture?
And we're asking for your stories like that one as part of our week-long series on debt in America. Tell us about your relationship with your bank or with debt, getting in it or out of it. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. We're also talking about Joe Lieberman, who didn't get a big punishment from Senate Democrats.
It's retribution by 1,000 cuts. I mean, Lieberman will be in the Senate for years to come, and I think real retribution will be determined over the months and years, in fact, with individual senators on an individual basis.
That's Todd Zwillick from PRI's Capital News Connection.
Talking about the Senate's form of revenge. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Hey, it's a Henry Paulson fruit salad.
You're dealing with apples and oranges here, and the apple is a very, very big apple.
The question I'm asking is the apple more important than the orange, or is the orange more important than the apple?
I'm saying that the forest through the trees here was...
Back when he was an investment banker, Henry Paulson probably never had to decide if oranges were more important than apples. On Capitol Hill, Show Me the Money meets Facing the Music. You liking them apples? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, November 19th, and the Treasury Secretary, he faced a lot of tough questions on Capitol Hill yesterday, and the apples, the oranges, the forests, it got a little confusing in there.
He was not liking them apples. Good morning, Adora.
Today, we're going to take a look at Congress and efforts to bail out the economy. Food for the times, spam sales are up, and a bankruptcy expert on the realities of credit card debt. All that coming up. First, these headlines.
And that's the spam you eat, not the spam you email, right?
Oh, that's a good point. Thank you.
CEOs of GM, Ford, and Chrysler head to Capitol Hill again today to make their case for an immediate $25 billion loan. Chrysler CEO Robert Nardelli says bankruptcy could spell the end for Chrysler.
We just can't be confident that we'll be able to successfully emerge from bankruptcy.
But a skeptical Richard Shelby, the Alabama senator, told CBS's Early Show that the car companies just haven't shown they can shift gears.
They have gone through, they've burned over $100 billion, as they say, trying to turn these companies around. I wish they could, but I don't believe this money will be paid back. I don't believe it'll be $25 billion. I believe it'll be $100 billion. It will just prolong the agony.
And while the automakers made their case before the Senate, Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson and Fed Chair Ben Bernanke were testifying in the House about the way they're injecting money directly into banks. Bernanke says, trust us, the plan's working.
There are some signs that credit markets, while still strained, are improving. Interbank short-term funding rates have fallen notably since mid-October, and we are seeing greater stability in money market mutual funds and in the commercial paper market.
But some on Capitol Hill may be thinking about the D word this morning, deflation. Concerns about U.S. automakers has been making investors jumpy. The Dow futures are dropping. The consumer price index dropped a record 1%. That's the largest amount in more than 60 years of keeping records. And housing starts reached a 1959 low.
Alaska's six-term Senator Ted Stevens turned 85 yesterday, but it wasn't such a happy birthday. 2 weeks after the election, it's clear that Democratic challenger Mark Bekich has defeated Stevens by more than 3,700 votes. One down, two to go. Minnesota Senate recounts gets underway today, and Georgia's runoff election will be on starting December 2nd.
So one component of that big CPI drop, oil's at $54 a barrel in Asian trading. The Dow was up yesterday, but it'll probably open lower in about a half an hour. The S&P gained nearly 1%. It begins trading at 8.59. So in our series all week long on debt and debt management in the U.S. economy, we're talking about the banking industry today. Tell us a story about your relationship with your bank. Has it wronged you? Do they charge you for making a phone call? What are the fees on your bill? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. The future of the banking business. You know it.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
We are working to maximize the authorities we have and the tools we have. And when the facts changed and the circumstances changed, we changed the strategy. We didn't implement a flawed strategy. We implemented a strategy that worked.
That, of course, is Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson. And if you're getting the impression that they're making it up as they go along in the so-called $700 billion rescue package on Capitol Hill, you may be right, because there's a broad consensus among economists that there is no real playbook for this kind of financial crisis, that making it up as you go along maybe is the best strategy. Paulson was on the Hill yesterday along with Ben Bernanke of the Federal Reserve talking about the progress of freeing up credit markets and whether or not some of this money should go to bail out the auto industry. Joining us now is Amity Schles. She's the author of The Forgotten Man, a new history of the Great Depression. Thanks so much for coming into the studio and being with us.
Good morning.
And I got your name right, correct?
Absolutely.
Yes, absolutely right. So, let's talk about the predicament of Henry Paulson up there. I mean, he's basically got to convey to Congress that the rules are changing, that it is a fluid situation. What do you make of how he is changing the rules and the strategy that he seems to have adopted here?
Well, all along, many observers had thought that it might be better for him to infuse capital into these companies than buy their troubled assets, because that basically lets them off free and also takes control of them when you buy up someone's assets. There was a sense that Washington was being forced to move to take over New York, and New York was being forced to move to Washington. So that shift is okay, but there is no clarity here. Why is it that Detroit doesn't get and Wall Street does? And that's a question for all of us.
Well, before we talk about the auto industry, I want to discuss the psychological components of this. The lending in the commercial credit markets seems to have freed up a little bit, it unfrozen. And Bernanke is correct in saying that interest rates are coming down and that banks are starting to lend and the commercial paper market is sort of coming back. What's going to bring other sectors of lending back? Because it is a psychological question of, do you feel like you should lend? Do you feel like it's safe to lend a million here, a couple of million there?
It's not totally psychological. It's also, what are the prospects for growth in the United States? And if you do things that make the prospects for growth much stronger, then you will see all the problems fade. Remember,
Like what?
Well, there are different ways to do it. One way to do it is to make the U.S. more relatively attractive to invest in. And there's an idea that no one is going to talk about now because it's politically very hard, which is you reduce capital gains taxes. You reduce the corporate tax. One of the reasons we're in trouble now is vis-a-vis London, we're less attractive than we used to be.
What does that mean in terms of money that we are not seeing that is going to London instead? And one of the criticisms of the kind of tax cut you're talking about is it is definitely not targeted at the broadest sort of consumer middle class.
Absolutely. That means is you have initial public offerings in London instead of here. Companies start there. Sometimes they create jobs there or elsewhere and not here. So you want to look what will cause job creation in addition to the other things people are talking about. And it's a big omission in the discussion because we're not in the 1950s. We're not in a vacuum where the rest of the world is on its back and we are the only economy. We are competing. And that's the part of the story that doesn't seem to get into the hearings at this moment.
In terms of the notion that we are competing because it is such a global market, thinking about the actions of the Treasury Secretary, I've heard some people describe them as erratic. And one thing markets hate, as we all know, is uncertainty. So this switching of strategy in the middle, while it may be in response to changing facts on the ground, how does that affect the confidence level?
We have very serious uncertainty right now. Exactly. And uncertainty is bad for markets. Markets hate unknown unknowns. And from the beginning, the arbitrary aspect of the Treasury bailout has frightened a lot of observers. Well, where did they get that 700 number? Why are they reducing it to 350 now? Why is it right that Detroit should not be part of it? All these questions are insufficiently answered. What you have actually is in the background two philosophers debating. One is Bagehot, the great UK philosopher who taught that in a crisis you supply liquidity, lend freely was the adverb that he used. Another is Keynes, whom Paulson was directly quoting, another UK economic philosopher, John Maynard Keynes. He said, when the facts change, I change my plan. What do you do? Are you a stuck in the mud ideologue?
Keynes was also an advocate of spending,
right,
on the spending side,
exactly.
Whereas the not on so much the lending side.
But
a battle of philosophers probably doesn't contribute to a feeling of equanimity on the part of the investors, though, right?
Absolutely.
To see two philosophers battling over billions of dollars makes you want to pull your money out of.
And you know, you see the limits. You see the limits of Bagehot, and you see the limits of Keynes because, after a while, Bagehot's liquidity becomes Keynes's stimulus. And I know this sounds very academic, but that's who they're quoting. It's two big guys.
Bagehot and Keynes. I have all their albums. Phil Graham described the Americans as whiners and that the recession that we are in is a function of people sort of convincing themselves that things are getting worse rather than better. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's unfair to use a quote from Phil Graham from earlier in the year to now. It's very hard to establish when a recession starts. Technically, when he said that, we were not in a recession. In the second quarter, we had 2% plus growth. Are we in a recession now? Probably. Should we worry about it? Probably not. We know we're in trouble. We need to fix the trouble. To focus on the technical definition of recession is sort of like saying, you know, do I still have a fever or do I not when I'm getting better? Or have I got the fever yet when I know I have the disease?
But forget the fever. Maybe the better question is, do you feel sick? And if you feel sick, there's some, that's something that's real. I mean, there's a lot of talk that like psychological negativity is sending the market down. But in fact, psychological positivity was partially responsible for this entire mess to begin with. It's all psychological.
Everyone, I think, understands at this point that there are certain laws and reforms that need to happen to make the U.S. economy be more stable and grow in the future. There are still big uncertainty. For example, Fannie and Freddie, you spoke of uncertainty before. Fannie and Freddie, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the ones who really set off the crisis in the view of a lot of us early in September when they went to the government, that hasn't been resolved. And the essential uncertainty of Fannie and Freddie was they were hybrids. They were half government, half market. They were traded, but they had this implicit government guarantee. And so that is still, you know,
those monsters could rear their heads
right.
again, is what you're saying.
They're part of the government now, but they're still problematic.
And it's $5 trillion in assets that are backed
right.
at Fannie and Freddie. What are you watching on that front, then, that might emerge between now and then early next year?
Will they make room for the private sector to move in here? This is related to me. I look at Detroit and say, what are they doing for them? And there are two kinds of things you can do for Michigan. One is you can just give them money out of the big package. That's what we're hearing in Washington. But another is you can do a set of things to help Michigan people find new jobs because their industry is a dinosaur, such as give their children full tuition to Michigan State and Ann Arbor. Give them enormous packages to finish their lives in a positive way, to go back to school, to have good pensions. It's possible to buy those people a good future without perpetuating the subsidy machine to the automakers. And you're not hearing a lot of that either. You're just hearing spend, spend, spend.
Is there a track record for those kinds of retraining programs? I mean, they're very interesting as you're proposing them there. And those are great schools, Michigan State and U of M.
Yeah, I think the U of M is a most excellent school.
What I mean is this is a finite number of people, 3 million. It sounds huge, but it's finite. We have actually discussed this quite a bit vis-a-vis farms, because farms and autos are the same. They get subsidy. Oil doesn't. It's just different industries. And when you buy off the farmer and you give his child an inheritance, then you also make a deal. I won't have to subsidize you and your grandchildren forever just because you call yourself farmer in America as a romantic connection with farms or autos. And so where is that package? If we're going to be spending hundreds of billions, that one should be there too.
And do you think we're going to lose one or two car makers? We're sort of asking everyone that this morning.
I think we're going to lose two.
That's what Alex Taylor said.
I know.
Fortune
we're two
magazine.
For two
oh,
today.
Two for two today.
Because
they are just not competitive. And because of all the other demands for the table, the liquidity demand, right? Many, many demands on the table.
Right. They've got all kinds of restructuring costs that are absolutely built in, including labor costs. Amity Schles, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Amity Schles is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. She's the author of The Forgotten Man, The New History of the Great Depression. We want you to think about stories of debt and debt management and your relationship with your banker. Elizabeth Warren is coming up. She's a law professor at Harvard who specializes in consumer bankruptcy and commercial law. You can reach us at 877-8 My Take or My Take at thetakeaway.org. Debt management, your relationship with your banker, making the banking business better. All that for our guest.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Just in time for the holidays, The Takeaway, of course, is doing a whole week series on debt. Yes, just for you. We're taking your questions about getting out of debt, and we'll have some answers for you on Friday. That's at thetakeaway.org. The entire debt series is on our website, and we've been talking about it all week.
I wouldn't say my relationship with my bank is dysfunctional. I would say it's abusive. Every month I pay my mortgage, and the value of my house goes down, which means I kind of owe more. You know, I'm just a heartbeat away from bankruptcy. I don't know why I don't just pack it all in and move to the woods somewhere.
No banks in the woods. Tell us your stories of how you would want to improve your banking relationship at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Part of Debtor Nation here on The Takeaway.
Debtor Nation, we have debts on cars and homes and just about everything else. All of our debt has gone through the roof. 5,000 people a day last month filed for bankruptcy, clearly a sign of many people struggling. We asked today, what's the safety net for ordinary consumers? Harvard Law Professor Elizabeth Warren specializes in consumer bankruptcy and commercial law and is the author of All Your Worth, The Lifetime Money Plan. Professor Warren has also just been named to the Bailout Oversight Board, and she joins us now with her thoughts from Boston. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you.
American consumers, they're clearly in trouble. Where do we start the discussion?
Well, if you're when I have a week long on debt, you couldn't have picked a better topic, because a big part of this problem is that American consumers are leaving a boom deeply in debt and with no rise in income. And this is important. Let me just put it in a historical context. What usually happens is as we come out of a boom and go into a recession, debt loads are smaller and income has risen. So in other words, they're a little fatter, so to speak, mm-hmm. economically. They're a little better shape.
There's a little cushion.
That's right, a little cushion. But this time we're hitting the skids as a country, you know, when everything's going into recession, with the families already deeply in debt. And that does not bode well for where we're headed over the next few years.
Let's start with credit cards. 50 million Americans carry credit card balances every month. And I want you to listen to what a caller said to us.
I have to share a credit card story. I looked at my statement. I got a late fee. The payment went in 3 days before it's usually due. I looked at my previous statement. They changed my due date from the 6th to the 1st. I called the credit card company, and they said, "We've evaluated your account, and we changed your cycle from 25 days to 20 days. So, yes, they did take off the late fee as a courtesy, but I'm not going to use that card anymore. I guess they could just do that, whatever they want to do, and then we pay all the fees attached."
Professor Warren, what do you make of that?
Well, the credit card companies have now written their agreements so that basically they can do anything they want to you anytime they want. And, many times they don't. There are some good cards out there. But they have structured it so that they can engage in tricks and traps in order to build revenues. And that's exactly what they're doing, and there's a perfect example of it. There are many practices like that. They are simply designed to rip $29 out of somebody's pocket, $49 out of somebody's pocket, drive up their interest rates over and over and over. And we're talking literally billions of dollars here.
Elizabeth, it's a business model question in the sense that there's so much foreclosure or default and fraud built into the cost of doing business for the credit card companies, and they try to recover this by doing these fees and all these sort of draconian and random charges that they do to customers. It sort of commits the entire industry to this float where it's just going to get higher and higher and higher, when actually the old way of doing this is just adjust the interest rate if the person needs a problem.
That's right. We have switched from a model where basically they lent to people they thought would be able to pay back, and they made it entirely transparent. Here's the interest rate. If you like it, take the card. If you don't like it, don't take the card. To what we call a tricks and traps business model, so that they tell you, oh, it's 0%. Those are the teaser rates. We give you free things. Those are the frequent flyer miles or the cash back. Or you should have a warm and fuzzy relationship with us. And what's happened is the credit card agreement itself has gone from about one page in 1980, according to the Wall Street Journal, to more than 30 pages today. And the additional 29 pages were not to help the customer. They were to develop all of these ways to get revenue out of people who roll over their credit cards, and frankly, even to get revenue out of people who believe that they are cash payers. That's the business model now. They are literally, literally making billions of dollars in just fees and charges, and $29 here, and you went over, and you were a day late, and
before we get to some of the solutions that you propose, just quickly address the issue of where's the line between individual discipline and the need to protect consumers?
You know, in my view, we shouldn't make credit cards idiot proof. That's not the point. The point is not that, you know, the nanny comes in and tucks you in with your credit card. You expect people not to go to the mall and not to run up big charges that they're not going to be able to pay for. And if they do that and it hurts to have to pay it back, shoot, that's how it should be. That's how the game should work. The part I object to is just like the clip you ran. It's the tricking people. It's the trapping people. It's hiding the cost of credit until it's too late and someone gets slammed in the side of the head with this kind of thing.
And is that where your Financial Product Safety Commission idea comes in? You want to tell us about that?
Absolutely. So it's based on this premise. You can't buy a toaster in the United States that has a 1 in 5 chance of exploding. But you can buy a mortgage that has a 1 in 5 chance of costing you your home, or you can buy a credit card that can throw you into financial chaos, even if you use it in the way it's supposed to be used. And so the reason for that difference is we evaluate all physical products for safety. You know, that it's got basic wiring, that cars have brakes, that infant car seats don't collapse. But we don't do that with consumer financial products. We say, in effect, to credit card companies, to mortgage companies, hey, you know, whatever you can get them to sign, however you want to bury the tricks and traps. And I think that's wrong. The reason it has grown up that way is our regulatory structure in Washington, D.C. is based on the people who follow credit cards or mortgages and have the right to regulate them. Their principal job is called the safety and soundness of the banks, which frankly means bank profitability. So you've got the people who are there to make sure that the banks are profitable, and all
right.
Yeah, they're going to take care of a little consumer protection.
That's a great idea.
Separate agency on consumer protection.
That's a great
separate
idea.
Agency. We'll have you come back and talk more about that. Elizabeth Warren, law professor at Harvard, who specializes in consumer bankruptcy and commercial law. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
She's also the co-author of All Your Worth, The Lifetime Money Plan.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Mark Garrison has just joined us with the latest headlines. Mark?
Thank you. It's 32 minutes after the hour. Wall Street is open for business. Relatively flat opening. Dow's down about 18 points at the moment. Oil is trading around $54 a barrel. That low price has caused a drop in gas prices, and that in turn affects consumer prices. In a new report out today, the consumer price index went down last month by the largest amount in decades. Meanwhile, new home construction fell 4.5%. It's now at the lowest level on record, and the U.S. military has arrested a member of Iranian security forces for sneaking weapons into Iraq. They detained him at Baghdad Airport yesterday. The U.S. has long accused Iran of arming Shiite extremist groups in Iraq. President-elect Barack Obama made a promise on the campaign trail to take care of the environment, and he renewed that vow yesterday.
My presidency will mark a new chapter in America's leadership on climate change that will strengthen our security and create millions of new jobs in the process.
He gave a taped address to a global warming summit in California. Now, we have a big database here at The Takeaway, and we scour it each day to find significant events in history that happened on this day so we can mark them properly. Now, today, for example,
I got some food business to do, so don't hold me up here too much. I mean, keep going. But
Lincoln gave the Gettysburg Address today, Apollo 12 landed on the moon, but these are part of the finest hours. But there are also some darker moments, so I just want to listen to some historical audio.
Is that Milli Vanilli?
November 19th, 1990, they were stripped of their Grammy, and Robin Fab did not sing this song. And there were howls of protest in the newsroom when I said I might not get to this. So for all of this, we mark this date.
Yes.
And you can like this song
it's
now because it's not those two guys
singing it.
The pre-9/11
era, Milli Vanilli mattered. Thank you, Mark Garrison. Stop. The torture must stop. Please. Please stop. Thank you very much. So all over America, people are looking for bargains, and they're definitely looking for bargains in the kitchen, especially when they look at their grocery bills week to week. And it's not a response to – it's nothing that you have to do involving packaged foods or going to McDonald's. No, there's an entire cuisine of bargain cooking that's left over from the Great Depression. And, of course, you've heard all the comparisons between the economic downturn now and the Great Depression. But joining us to talk about this venerable history of bargain food and the recipes that go with it are James Beard, award-winning cookbook authors and proprietors of BoiledPeanuts.com, Matt and Ted Lee. Guys, thanks for coming down. It is fabulous in here. There's a boom in certain foods that are cheap. Tell us about that first. And what are the strategies for making a meal on just a few cents?
That's true. There's a boom in sort of recession foods. And first off, beans, dried beans, like we think boring. But there are a lot of great heirloom varieties of beans out there. They're super cheap, you know, like $1.29 a pound kind of thing.
And a pound of beans,
I mean,
that's like a month.
Makes a ton. Exactly.
That's a month of beans.
Exactly. Also in cuts of meat, the inexpensive cuts are actually the hottest cuts. Like all the chefs all across the country are onto inexpensive cuts like pork shoulder, like beef shank steaks. And, you know, something like a pork shoulder, which is what we brought in today for you guys, is, you know, about 89 cents a pound. So you're talking a 10-pound pork shoulder, you're paying like $8.50.
Wow.
I mean, it's just and knowing how to cook it up is important.
Well, before we get to the recipe, and I want to talk about that, what other beneficiaries have there been of this recession boom? I'm thinking of things like Spam and Velveeta, foods that are associated with the earlier, you know, mid-20th century where, you know, people were wanting convenience and cheapness in their food.
Well, I mean, you see the whole category of home cooking beginning to gain, and this is something that's very exciting to us. We've been sort of preparing for this segment our whole lives, being freelancers.
Really?
I mean, we make a science out of this challenge. And now we make a career out of encouraging people to get into the kitchen and cook. The basic thing is, if you can plan ahead 2 days in the kitchen rather than just for tonight, you can go a long way toward saving tons of money just by avoiding those urges to go out and buy convenience food, packaged food, prepared food.
And those are strong urges.
They are strong urges, and I feel them every day. But if you can just amortize your food purchases over a slightly longer period of time, not a ton, but just, you know, buy an extra large chicken instead of the small one that'll feed just you and your partner, you can create those lunches that come and those leftovers.
And it's sort of the strategy of maintaining leftovers. And there's also you can do the key to this strategy is a mix of super cheap grains and maybe some higher expensive fresh produce, which is going to cost you. But if the mix is right, it all evens out.
Exactly. Right.
So what have I got in front of me here?
Those are some red field peas or cow peas, $1.29 a pound.
Oh, they're great.
Just cook them up with a little bit of garlic, a little bit of chili pepper, a bay leaf, and that's basically it.
But you have to soak them for 3 years?
What's wonderful about these beans, and the reason we brought them is that they totally shake up that boring rice and black beans or rice and pinto beans dynamic. They're a different variety. They're smaller. They've got a really earthy, lovely flavor, and they're the traditional bean in the South Carolina Lowcountry for making Hop and John, which, as I'm sure you know, is a good luck dish.
Sure. Good for you?
Good fortune in the new year.
But good for you.
Good for you, of course. All legumes, and especially legumes combined with rice, have this unique nutritional property of creating a complete protein or a nearly complete protein as close as you could get to meat.
That's interesting. And the other thing that you guys talk about a lot, something that's near and dear to me, is condiments and how you can kind of spice up the meal if you spend a little money on some good condiments.
Absolutely. And it seems a little bit counterintuitive to sort of go crazy with your condiments. But if you spend a little bit on condiments you really love, like a really good salt or a really good freshly ground, you know,
that's what this really, is. Really good peppercorns.
Yeah, those are
malted
really good
salt. It's made in the east of England, and it's just wonderful. It almost tastes sweet. It's these flaky sort of fish scale like texture, and it costs like $5 for, you know, more than Domino crystals.
Now, Matt and Ted, how do you keep this from becoming kind of like dorm food where, you know, you just sort of mix some stuff up with ketchup and put it in the microwave?
Well, you'll see on those beans, for example, we used a really nice finishing olive oil, you know, that just a few drops.
So good.
And it somehow, you know, it just takes it to another level. It makes it feel like a real indulgence.
Dude.
It makes it feel decadent.
And gets you into the kitchen.
I'm coming to your house for dinner.
Enough with the beans. I'm tasting this pork shoulder. This is outrageous.
Yeah, that's a...
Great. How long do you cook it?
That cooked for about 4 hours in a pretty high temperature oven. But the secret is that you take the pork shoulder. You wrap it in another sort of recession food. You wrap it in collard greens, actually.
Right. Mm.
And you wrap it in tin foil. You put it in the oven. 4 hours, and it becomes sort of like a mock barbecue.
Our website, thetakeaway.org, has your recipe for pork
right.
shoulder. Before we go, and I'm going to take a sip of this is corn cob wine.
The ultimate thrift beverage.
How much does this cost?
Well, you have to make it yourself.
I see.
When you cut the corn from the cob and freeze it, you're left with the cobs, and don't throw them away. Make wine.
Don't throw them away. Make wine. Oh, that's fantastic. It could be the name of the next book for Mike Lee and Ted Lee, James Beard award-winning cookbook authors and proprietors of Southern Food Store, BoiledPeanuts.com, with some great ideas for bargains.
That's Matt Lee.
Every day. Matt Lee. Oh, sorry. Sorry. Thanks, guys.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckenberry. And on the line with us is Matthew Hill, who's the BBC health correspondent, to talk about an interesting development, what could be a real breakthrough in the technology of stem cells and transplantation. Matthew, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
Matthew's in London. And the operation that we're talking about here and the breakthrough that we're talking about is a woman by the name of Claudia Castillo, who got a windpipe transplanted into her airway there, the windpipe, of course, between the mouth and the lungs there. It's where the air goes. And this windpipe that was transplanted into her came from her own stem cells. First of all, why is this a breakthrough? And number two, how do they do it?
Well, what's amazing here is that transplants so far, we've had transplants with hearts, etc., livers, but they are from other patients, and patients then have to live under a regime of very powerful anti-rejection medication. That medication can take 10 years off their life. It's not nice to take. And if you get cancer, for instance, then your cancer can just spread throughout your body if you're on these immunosuppressants. What happened here is that they had a donated windpipe. They then treated it in Italy with a special technique that removed all the biological cells from it, leaving just a scaffold of cartilage. And then stem cells from Claudia, the patient, were taken from her bone marrow. They went through a unique process in Bristol in England where they were matured into cartilage cells. Then they were seeded around the donor trachea. And essentially, that was transplanted into her body, replacing a broken windpipe that she had, damaged from TB, replacing that windpipe and tricking her body into thinking that it was part of her.
Well, let's talk about the trick for a moment. The scaffold, this sort of skeleton of, I guess it's mostly cellulose of or cartilage of the old windpipe, is not hers, but
no,
the tissue that's grown on this skeleton is hers. So maybe it's less of a trick than you're saying.
Well, what's amazing is they've managed to develop the stem cells and into cartilage-type material. That's the real trick, I think, that's happened. And that's the Bristol University team have done that. And it's developed not only the outer layer of the windpipe, the inner layer is the epithelium, as it's known. So that fuses into her body. And, you know, just a few days after it was put in, they could see it had actually kind of grown into her body the way it had evolved.
Well, you're the only person who's actually interviewed her, the only journalist who's interviewed her. Let's hear how her voice sounds.
It was very hard to have conversations before with my family. I had to tell them, now please don't talk because I need to breathe, and that was very difficult for me to keep up the relationship. And now with the operation, it is much easier.
Well, you can hear behind there in Spanish that she sounds like she's doing fine speaking. Last question, is there any sense that this happened in Europe partly because of the controversy over stem cells in the United States, or is exciting research going on all over the globe here?
Well, there is exciting research all over the globe. I mean, this is published in The Lancet, the medical journal, today, and it's the first of what could be many operations that the same technique could be applied to the colon, to the bladder, to other similar organs. So it's a very exciting development, and something the stem cell community internationally have been looking to for the last 10 years or so.
And the applications relate to organs that can develop this scaffold, where you can
get
to sort of a scaffold. Well, Matthew
That's
Hill,
the idea.
Thanks so much for joining us. Matthew Hill is in London. He's the BBC health correspondent from our partners, the BBC, talking about a transplanted windpipe using stem cell research.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, November 19th. Mark Garrison is here with the latest headlines. Mark?
Coming up on 12 minutes before the hour, new economic news just out this morning. October's consumer price index dropped a record 1%. That is the lowest rate in more than six decades. Also reaching historic lows, the number of new homes built, that plunged 4.5%. Also breaking this morning, Al-Qaeda's number two man, Ayman al-Zawahiri, is criticizing President-elect Barack Obama in a new audio message. It's the first public Al-Qaeda comment about the president-elect's victory. Al-Zawahiri said the president-elect's plan to shift troops to Afghanistan is doomed to fail. There's word that Eric Holder has informally accepted an offer to become President-elect Barack Obama's attorney general. If nominated and confirmed, he'd be the first African-American to hold the cabinet post. And speaking of the president-elect, Washington, D.C. is preparing for up to 5 million people to crowd the Capitol for the inauguration. The city is thinking it'll be between at least three, as many as 5 million that'll pack the mall, a National Mall, on January 20th. That would shatter previous records, and I was actually surprised to see which president holds that record. My guess would have been Reagan in 85. He won every state but the District of Columbia and Minnesota, so it was a blowout win and charismatic guy. But it was actually Lyndon Johnson in 1965. He drew 1.2 million people, and that's the record they expect Obama to break pretty substantially.
So it'll go from 1.2 million to 5?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's like Khomeini.
As many as five. It'd be somewhere between three and five is what they're hoping for. So all the cops are on duty. Huge. Lots of concerns about transit, traffic, hotels. But hopefully everyone is nice if they all come together. The Treasury Department says China has now overtaken Japan as the U.S.'s largest foreign creditor. China now owes nearly $600 billion worth of U.S. Treasury bonds. Also a suspected—
Owns, not owes. I mean, they own them, right?
Owns, yes.
Right.
Yeah.
So China owes
O's?
You and me.
Correct, yeah.
Well, great.
That's the news.
Thanks for that headline. We're talking about debt big time. The Chinese hold it or not.
Despite my 838 credit rating, I had nothing but trouble trying to take out a home equity loan. I have talked to a couple of dozen people. Never once spoke to the same person twice. My advice for anyone out there who is seeking any kind of loan, deal with a small bank, a neighborhood bank. You'll be better off.
All week long, we're talking about debt and managing it. What's your relationship with your banker? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And John, as you know, there are two outstanding Senate races still undecided as we speak. And one of those is in Minnesota. And if you ever doubted if your vote would count, you need to look no further than that Senate race there. 2.9 million people cast a ballot. And Republican incumbent Norm Coleman leads his Democratic challenger Al Franken by just 215 votes. It's so close, the results have triggered an automatic recount, which is going to get underway shortly. And for more on that, we go to Tom Scheck from Minnesota Public Radio. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. How you doing?
Good. And how are you there?
Just getting ready to start counting the ballots. I got my abacus here and a graph and a pencil, and I'm just going to go 1, 2, 3 to get to 2.9 million.
So, Tom, let's start at the beginning here. Have all of the votes been counted?
They were counted by the scanning optical machines. As you know, they process these things through machines. And now what's going to happen is they're going to start going through these ballots one by one, and election officials are going to go through and start putting them in piles. Here's one for Al Franken. Here's one for Norm Coleman. Here's one who voted for someone else or wrote someone in. And there are going to be two people on either side, one for Norm Coleman and one for Al Franken. And basically, whenever they disagree with that election judge who's making the determination on, you know, this is a vote for Al Franken or Norm Coleman, they're going to be able to challenge that and put it in a separate pile. And when they do that, all of those challenged ballots are going to eventually make their way, we're hoping, by December 16th, to this group called the State Canvassing Board, which is the Secretary of State and four judges, two Supreme Court judges from Minnesota and two local judges. And then they're going to determine what the voter intent was. So if someone circled Norm Coleman's name instead of filled in that bubble, like all of the young students out there who've taken standardized tests, they're going to know, they're going to say, okay, that's a vote for Norm Coleman. And that's where they're going to pretty much, that's where a lot of the fist fights almost are going to happen there.
So break this down for us. How did it get to be such a close race in a state that went solidly for Democrat Barack Obama on the presidential ticket?
Well, part of the reason was that a lot of voters weren't convinced about Al Franken, and Norm Coleman is part of the reason for that. They've really tried to question him, say he wasn't fit to be a senator. But at the same time, there were a lot of people who weren't happy with Norm Coleman, and you know they said he was too close to President Bush. So there was almost this sense where folks were just, they weren't sure who they were going to vote for. And I talked to a lot of folks who just said, boy, I didn't make my final decision until I got into the voting booth and I decided to vote for Al Franken or I decided to vote for Norm Coleman. There was another factor in play. We had a third-party candidate, the party from Jesse Ventura, the former governor, the Independence Party, and he sucked about 15% of the vote or so. So that kind of sucked a little bit of the air out of both of the major party candidates.
Well, it made it a much more complicated process. You know, I've seen Al Franken in the days after this election and in the hours leading up to the recount. I mean, he looks so buttoned up. I mean, he looks so non-comedian-like. I mean, he's trying to look like a senator. He ends up actually looking like someone on the vestry at some, like, Episcopal church there in the Twin Cities handing out programs on Sunday.
It's amazing. I mean, here's a guy who the Coleman campaign framed him as this guy who, you know, he's way over the top in terms of the jokes he makes, and they pretty much trotted out all of these inappropriate jokes that every constituency out there could be offended by. And so he was so buttoned up that we were like, is this guy really a comedian throughout the entire campaign? Because he very rarely joked. Near the end in some of the debates, you could tell that he had that sense of a comedian and the timing, because sometimes he would throw a zinger at Coleman, but you never really saw it on the stump. He talked a lot about how serious he was, because I think he was almost overcompensating for the fact that people view him as a comedian.
And he's from Albert Lea, which is the funniest city in Minnesota.
Just saying Albert Lea makes me laugh. So.
Well, Tom, let me ask you this. Is there a lot of confidence across the board with the canvassing board that is in charge now of the recount? Will the results be taken seriously and considered credible?
Eventually, yes. I mean, everyone is kind of expecting this to end up in the courts, because either campaign can contest the election. But there's been a lot of discussion. There's been a lot. Republicans have been criticizing the Secretary of State because he's a Democrat. They don't have confidence in him. But at the same time, Democrats are kind of saying, well, look, these two Minnesota Supreme Court justices have ties to the Republican Party. So there's a little bit of concern on both sides. Now, all of these people on this canvassing board have said, hey, we're in there to do a job. There may be some ballots that might be questionable that we're going to have to rule on eventually. But they say when they put on that robe, the judges, or when they set up and sit down and start looking at this, they're going to be very professional about it.
Although, Tom, now, I would think that the experience in 2000 would scare those justices. losses, not wanting to have around their necks the idea that they called the election. I think they're going to be looking for a way for the voters to make this clear and that they're just enablers of the recount.
Well, that's going to be the thing. I mean, the difficult thing may be that there could be up to 5,000 ballots that go before this canvassing board.
Wow.
And if there's 5,000, then they're going to really be the kind of deciders here in terms of, okay, well, we think this is a Norm Coleman ballot or an Al Franken ballot. I mean, we were kind of trying to get from them a sense of, how many ballots are you going to look at? Is it going to be 100? Is it going to be 500? And they said, these are the campaigns that were saying, we're not sure. We're prepared for anything from 500 ballots to 5,000 ballots. They set aside 3 days, and they say that they're going to look at every ballot. It could take 3 minutes to make a decision on every mm-hmm. ballot when it goes through that way. And so they're like, well, we have 3 days, but it could go longer if necessary.
Well, Tom, just so you know, the whole country has its eyes on Minnesota, and especially Democrats, because obviously it's not lost on you that this is a very important race now with Democrats holding a 58-seat majority in the Senate. With this race in Minnesota and the race in Georgia, you guys are it.
Yeah, and the Republicans and Democrats on the national level know this. They're spending a lot of money here. You get these fundraising alerts from both sides saying, you know, Al Franken's trying to steal the election, or, you know, Norm Coleman's only up 215 votes. They really try to sensationalize it to raise money off of it, because both sides say they're going to need to raise like $2 to $3 million for a recount fund.
Tom Scheck, thank you.
You got it.
Tom Scheck is a reporter for Minnesota Public Radio.
Those ballots go in the Norm Coleman pile over there, or you got the Al Franken pile? It's going to be a great recount.
$2 million each side. I mean, that's a lot of money for a recount.
Yeah. Oh, you can't challenge that one. I mean, I wonder if it's going to add something to the language, like hanging chads added for
Let's
Florida.
Cross our fingers and hope not.
Those are optical scanners, so maybe less of a linguistic resource there. Well, we're talking about debt, banking, and credit cards in addition to the election all day.
Our debt problem in this country is our problem. It's Americans' problem. We can't blame the banks or the lending institutions for making cheap debt available to us. We don't have to take it.
Little responsibility project there from one of our listeners. Do you only blame yourself? Here's another take.
The credit card agreement itself has gone from about one page in 1980 to more than 30 pages today. And the additional 29 pages were not to help the customer.
There's your takeaway. Harvard Law Professor Elizabeth Warren, expert in consumer bankruptcy and commercial law, and as of Friday, a member of the Bailout Oversight Board. We're focusing on debt all week, and we want to hear, do you feel like your bank has wronged you? Are you piling up fees from your ATM or credit card? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And if you missed anything, subscribe to our podcast at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.